We are back talking to Professor Catherine Olmsted of UCD about Elizabeth Bentley, the most important female spy in the history of the Cold War. It's 1948. It's an election year. Elizabeth Bentley's story has hit the front pages of America's newspapers. Harry Truman does not like J. Edgar Hoover. He does not give Hoover the jurisdiction over foreign intelligence gathering that he covets. Instead, the OSS is revamped into the Central Intelligence Agency. Now, the FBI knew nothing about Elizabeth Bentley's spy rings until she came to them. Hoover, ever the political infighter, decides to shift the recriminations from his FBI onto Truman's administration. Elizabeth Bentley then appears before the House Un-American Activities Committee and becomes even more of a sensation.
Right, although actually Hoover's not instrumental in putting her before the cameras. She's the one who decides to take her story to the newspapers, and then the House Un-American Activities Committee decides to subpoena her. And Harry Truman is very upset about this because among the people that she's naming are people who were in his administration, including the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, Harry Dexter White. So in 1948, she goes before the House Un-American Activities Committee. And the and HUAC hears that there is an editor in New York who can verify her story. And so they subpoena a man named Whitaker Chambers to come support her. And that's when the whole Alger Hiss case emerges, is when Chambers is subpoenaed in response to Bentley's testimony. And when Chambers comes before HUAC, he tells his story, which was that he was a courier in Washington in the years before she took over, in the mid-1930s, and that when he was a courier in Washington, D.C. for the Soviets, one of his contacts was a State Department official named Alger Hiss. Now, Hiss was not, he was a mid-level State Department official, and he did not steal any important information. But the case becomes very symbolically important because he was a New Deal official, and he immediately denies that he had anything to do with this. He denies Chambers' story, and it becomes quite the media story that Chambers versus Hiss, who is telling the truth. And it comes to be freighted with so much political significance for the era because the Republicans try to imply, well, if this mid-level New Deal official was a communist spy, then the New Deal is tainted with communism. And in fact, the New Deal was entirely a communist project. And so a lot of liberals start defending Hiss as a way of defending the New Deal. And one's opinion of Franklin Roosevelt sort of becomes intertwined with one's opinion of Alger Hiss. And so that's why the Hiss case becomes so terribly important, even though Chambers was not that important a spy and Hiss was not that important a spy.
Whitaker Chambers is much better known to students of history for the Alger Hiss case and its role with Richard Nixon, making him a household name. But Chambers' appearance would have had much less impact had not Elizabeth Bentley gone before the HUAC before him to tell her story and lay the groundwork for his.
Right. They might not have ever thought of giving him a subpoena if not for Bentley's testimony.
Now, Elizabeth Bentley told the FBI about a spy named Hiss in the State Department. Whitaker Chambers then told the story of Alger Hiss in exquisite detail. Richard Nixon, then a freshman congressman from California, decides to get intimately involved in the case of Alger Hiss, and it makes Nixon politically. He gets put on the GOP ticket in 1952 as vice president, eventually becomes president in 1968.
And this is why a lot of people have, over the years, really resisted believing in Alger Hiss's guilt. Because if Alger Hiss was guilty, then it seems that Richard Nixon was right about that one thing about the Hiss case. And since he rode that to such prominence, it's hard to accept that, in fact, he might have been right about Hiss's guilt. But it seems from the documents that have come out recently, it's harder and harder to believe that Alger Hiss was innocent. As I said, though, the important thing is to keep it in context and what was Hiss guilty of. He was guilty of being one mid-level government official stealing governmental gossip in the mid-1930s. And the case was just not nearly as important as it came to seem in the Cold War era. Just because he stole those few bits of information does not mean that the whole New Deal was a communist project. But because the Republicans portrayed it that way, then it just became this the case of the century.
Now, as she's firmly implanted in the anti-communist camp, Bentley observes people like Whitaker Chambers making a career out of being ex-communists. When she tries to follow in their footsteps, however, she's frustrated.
She was very frustrated. She charged $300 a lecture, and she did have a few lectures at the beginning. She sold her autobiography for a few thousand dollars, but she was not able to live on her writings and her lectures the way that she had hoped. And she started looking at the men who were making a career out of this, including Whitaker Chambers and this man named Louis Boudens, who had been a communist journalist who made quite a career as an anti-communist columnist in the late 40s and early 50s. And so she started to say, well, this is unfair. I'm being discriminated against because I'm a woman, and I really should be making more money at this. My story is much more interesting than Boudens's or Chambers. How come I'm not cashing in the way I'd like? And she becomes more and more bitter. She starts demanding that the FBI pay her if they want any information, and she starts drinking more and more.
Well, it would seem, looking back from today's perspective, that she had a point about being ignored. It's interesting that in your book you describe how she had to be fitted to the conventions of the era in which she lived. The right portrayed her, the blonde, red spy queen, seductress, whereas her attackers from the left were portraying her as a frustrated, hard-drinking neurotic.
Right. When she first comes out in the newspapers, she doesn't give her name, and they don't have a picture of her. It's all anonymous at the beginning. And so the New York World Telegram, to whom she tells her story the first time, calls her the blonde spy queen. And they describe her as young, although she's 40. They describe her as glamorous and seductive. And so then when she finally does go public, and she looks very much, I mean, she looked much older than 40, actually. So she looks very much like she's this middle-aged matron. A lot of her critics jump on that and say, in fact, well, she's not the blonde spy queen. She's not a femme fatale. She's just this neurotic old spinster. And so they have a sort of battle of the stereotypes for a while. And this also makes her very angry and disillusioned and starts her drinking again.
Of course, in her biography, Bentley plays the PR game herself, indicating that she was led astray by her Soviet spy lover, Jacob Golos, when in fact your research has established that that's not really true.
Yeah, so she just portrays herself in a third way. You know, I'm not a neurotic spinster, I'm not a femme fatale, but in fact, I say in the book, she's a communist June Cleaver. You know, she says that she simply got into this because she keeps calling him her husband, even though they were never married. Her husband got her into it, and her husband told her what to do, and she loved him and believed in him implicitly and never did anything that he didn't tell her to do, which in fact is just so completely against everything she had ever done in her whole life that everyone at the time realized that it was a very false portrayal, which contributes to people not believing her. And so they say, well, she's obviously lying about so many things. She's lying about her relationship with Golos. She's lying. She's writing these books and articles that feel so false that maybe she's lying about all of the spy stuff as well. And so for years, historians virtually ignored her, and she's not in the textbooks because no one really knew what to make of her. You know, and they thought, well, maybe if she was making it all up, then she's not historically significant. You know, she was just some neurotic woman who helped contribute to the Red Scare, but who essentially we shouldn't pay much attention to because she was just a psychopath. And people couldn't evaluate her. And it's only in the last 5 years that the former Soviet Union has intermittently opened up its archives, and people have gone in there and said, oh, my gosh, you know, she was telling the truth about the spy. No, obviously not about her own personality and her own relationships, but she was telling the truth about the spying.
Your research established that Bentley was telling the truth when she came over to the FBI side, but that once interest in her story had waned, she began to embellish.
And that's what she told one of her boyfriends in the early 50s, is she confessed to him that she was having to invent new stories because this was the only way for her to make a living, because the newspapers in 1952 weren't interested in what she said in 1948. But when she had come forward in 1948, she had said everything she knew. So by the early 50s, when the money runs out from her autobiography and the FBI isn't coming calling anymore, and she believes not paying her for valuable information, she believes that, well, to get in the newspapers again, to get on the radio, to get lecture gigs, I need to embellish what I've already said. And that's what she starts doing.
So ultimately, she told the truth and she was a liar, making both her critics and defenders correct.
That's true, yeah.
Elizabeth Bentley plays a role in the two most famous court espionage cases of the Cold War. We've mentioned the Alger Hiss case. Tell us a bit about the other celebrated case, that of the Rosenbergs.
Golos controlled Julius Rosenberg. Julius Rosenberg was an engineer in New York who worked for the federal government for a short time during World War II. And he and some of his friends helped to steal military information and give it to Golos. And Bentley, as Golos's assistant, saw Rosenberg, never talked to him in person, but she knew his first name. She saw him from a distance so she could describe him physically, and she talked to him on the telephone. When she defected to the FBI, she gave all of this information, which was somewhat sketchy. You know, this tall, thin New York engineer with glasses named Julius, who was stealing military information for us. They obviously can't make an identification just with a first name. But then later, thanks to their decryptions of Soviet cables, the FBI starts breaking open the atomic spy case, and eventually they're led to Julius Rosenberg, and she helps confirm that he is in fact the person that they're looking for, because he has the same physical appearance and the same first name as the man that she knew during the war. Now, what we now know is that Julius Rosenberg was a military spy. He had very little significance as an atomic spy, because he recruited his brother-in-law, who was a sergeant to the machine shop at Los Alamos, to give him information about the atomic bomb. But his brother-in-law didn't even have a high school education, and, you know, he kind of drew a sketch of what he thought one part of the atomic bomb looked like. But he didn't really give anything of substance to the Soviet Union. But Rosenberg was a significant military spy, but the government, the prosecution, portrayed him as giving the secret of the atomic bomb to the Russians. And they wanted to know who else had helped Rosenberg in his military spying in New York. And so to pressure him into confessing, the prosecutors and the FBI arrested Ethel, who had nothing to do with Julius's spying, and indicated to Julius, well, if you don't talk, then she's going to go to the chair with you. And he refused to talk, and so they were both ultimately executed, when in fact the worst thing that you could say about her was that she was an accessory and that she knew about a crime but did not report it. The Rosenberg case, in particular the treatment of Ethel, I think is one of the more horrifying events of the Red Scare.
It would appear that after the Rosenberg case, Elizabeth Bentley becomes something of a forgotten person.
Even the Soviets can't locate her, actually. At one point, there's some documents that indicate the Soviets were cabling each other back and forth between Moscow and New York, saying, you know, whatever happened to Elizabeth Bentley? Maybe we should track her down and kill her for being an informer. And they can't find out where she's living. She's so dropped out of the news. She tries to make a career as a teacher. She had briefly worked at a girls' school between her college and her graduate school career. And so she uses all of her contacts in the anti-communist Catholic community to get appointed to be a professor at a Catholic women's college in Chicago, whereupon she promptly moves in with a guy and starts drinking a lot and having lots of fun partying in Chicago. And so they fire her. And then she starts this downward spiral where she teaches at another women's college, and then she teaches at a Tony Episcopal Girls High School. And then finally she ends up, the only job she can get is teaching at a reform school in Connecticut, where she ends her life. She dies in 1963 at the age of 55 of abdominal cancer. And it's quite probable that this was exacerbated by all her drinking.
Well, it was a sad end to a woman who led, if nothing else, a very interesting life. In the wake of September 11th, there's a crisis in confidence over our intelligence agencies. Are there any lessons we might learn from Cold War espionage cases like Bentley's?
Yes. In some ways, it's hard to make parallels because things have changed a lot in the FBI over the last 55 years. Certainly, what I observed from reading the FBI files from the 1940s, the FBI was not a terribly impressive investigative agency back in World War II and immediately afterwards. The FBI knew about Jacob Golos, had him in their files, and yet failed to realize that the woman he was living with was also a part of his espionage network. So they knew nothing about her. The FBI did not show itself very well in the Bentley case. I think always what we need to remember with the FBI is that we need to balance our concern for security and secrecy with our belief in democracy. And so the FBI cannot be allowed to have total secrecy and no accountability, because then there are all kinds of abuses that the high officials in the FBI can get away with if nobody's watching. And my first book was about congressional investigations of the CIA and FBI in the 1970s. And during those investigations, all kinds of things came out about the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover and what it had gone on to do after the Bentley case. The FBI became so obsessed with catching communists that all sorts of restraints were loosed. And for example, in the most egregious case, J. Edgar Hoover became convinced that Martin Luther King Jr. was a communist, and therefore he could use any sorts of techniques necessary to catch him. You know, the ends justified the means. And, you know, he started tape recording what he claimed were King's extramarital affairs, and then mailed him a copy and tried to convince him to commit suicide. And there were many violations like that. And this is because during the height of the Cold War, Congress totally let the FBI do whatever it wanted to do. Protect us from communists, and we won't ask any questions. And this is what I fear might happen in today's climate. And I hope that we've learned the lessons from those bad old days so that they don't happen again, and realize that we need to at least have an aggressive committee in Congress keeping secrets, but making sure that the FBI does not take its potential total power over Americans' lives and subvert our democracy.
J. Edgar Hoover's been dead for 30 years now. It's been said in the wake of September 11th that the FBI is still very much the agency he created, for better or worse. And sometimes that's for worse, even today.
Hoover did have an amazing impact in that he was a director for almost 50 years. But I also think it's a mistake to think, well, he died in 1972, and so therefore the FBI is a completely different animal. Because the investigations that Congress conducted in the mid-1970s supposedly led to a lot of reforms. But as early as the 1980s, the FBI was back to doing things like investigating the committee in solidarity with the people of El Salvador, basically a group of Americans who were helping Salvadoran refugees, and started doing the same things with that committee that it had done to civil rights groups in the 1960s, as believing, well, if some group is opposed to American foreign policy, then it is un-American and that it is legitimate to, you know, infiltrate it and subvert it. Even since the reforms of the 1970s, the FBI has committed some abuses.
Evidently, they have. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Olmsted, for telling us this story.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
If you'd like to learn more about this most interesting topic, we'd recommend that you snag a copy of Red Spy Queen, a biography of Elizabeth Bentley, available from your local bookseller. You know, it occurs to me after all this talk that James Bond resembles real-world espionage about as closely as Batman resembles real-world law enforcement. That's it for today's show. We will see you again next Thursday at 5 o'clock. I am Douglas Everett, and this was Radio Parallax. Stay tuned now for Electricity and Lust with Gina.